Good afternoon. We are ready to hear our next speaker in the cafe room. Our next speaker is Chris Carlson, a longtime San Francisco community organizer, co-founder of Processed World of Critical Mass, many publications. He'll be talking about some soon-to-be-published work today. Please welcome Chris Carlson.
Hi, all you lunch eaters. Nice to be at the Anarchist Book Fair once again, year after year. We all turn out and get to see each other after missing out on chances to talk as much as we might like, so it's very good to be here. I'm going to try to ramble for about 15 minutes, maybe, slight give or take a few, and then invite you to engage in a conversation with me as the next person sets up. Today I'm going to talk about a new book that I'm writing that AK Press will publish later this year, I hope, called Nowtopia. And Nowtopia, the tagline on it is how pirate programmers, outlaw bicyclists, and vacant lot gardeners are inventing the future today. So the book is going, I'll get to a little bit of the book in a minute, but I just want to set it up a little bit with my own background because I think that's an important way to understand why this book is happening and why I'm interested in this particular line of inquiry that I'm interested in. I started many years ago when I was in my early 20s. I came out of being a college dropout, and you know, what did I learn how to do in college? Shuffle information, pass data back and forth. Most people get to learn that, if nothing else, while they're in college, how to facilitate your engagement with bureaucracies. And one of the most clear lessons that I derived from that experience, and that led to me and a bunch of friends starting a magazine called Processed World, was that most of the work that we were doing was a total waste of time and should be put away. We shouldn't do all the jobs we do. And if you start rethinking how life is organized in this world and how little of the work that we do really has any practical use for our own well-being or anybody else's, it's mostly about shuffling information around that essentially keeps the edifice of capital going or the state or some combination of the two. So with that background, one of the things that you notice then is that most of us set up our lives as best we can. We have to cope, we have to make a living, we have to make money because we live in a capitalist society. So we do something for money. But it's not really what makes us feel fully alive or fully engaged. Most of what we do for our full humanity takes place outside of what we do for money, outside of our wage labor gig. And part of the essence of that truth that I just want to emphasize is it's at the point of sale, when you have a job, it's precisely at the moment that you've agreed to sell your time and your skills to a job is the moment you just lost control over the world. Because as a wage laborer, you have relinquished any decision making, or not to mention all your civil rights, to have any real say over what the purpose of your own activity is all day long. So instead of waking up in the morning deciding, well, what should we do today? What needs to be done? Let's have a conversation about it. Let's have a democratic process in which the choices that we make as people who can contribute are made together and with a sense of the purposefulness of it and the usefulness of it. We never even have that conversation. Well, what do we do? We say, oh, you don't like your work? Get another job. There's never a sense that we actually have a right to do useful and meaningful work. And of course, in the anarchist world, there's a great deal of political energy that's gone on for quite a while to be anti-work, which of course I share that politics. I did Processed World for years, and I understand why that's a useful place to start a conversation. But with this new book that I'm working on, Nowtopia, what I really want to talk about is the fact that whatever your political stance is, no matter how radical or tepid it may be, there's a moment that's going to confront us all where we do have to decide what to do and how to do it. And I would like that conversation to start sooner than later, because I think one of the ways we might actually talk about revolution in this culture is by making a vision that we can somehow articulate together in a way that's not really abstract and it's not super densely politically theoretical, but it gets the point over. Life can be radically better than this. The world we're living in is fucked up, and life can be radically better for everyone, and we need to figure out how to be able to get that point across. Now, with that in mind, I started thinking about this because I do come out of a fairly theoretical background. I'm somewhat fond of Karl Marx as a way to understand capitalism, not as a prescription for how to organize society. I'm fond of all the different kind of critiques of authority and hierarchy and oppression and whatnot. They're all useful. Everything's got something to offer to the discussion. But we go on through the daily life, and we don't really get to fully develop our critique in a way that allows us to go forward together. So that's kind of, I really wanted to see that in spite of the fact that the critique is not there, that we don't articulate it, people actually behave in interesting ways. the everyday activities that people are engaged in are very often radically subversive to the status quo. And so the book's purpose is to say, wow, there's all this idea of the theory of revolution, how it should happen either at the workplace or by organizing in communities or organizing across ethnicities and all these different issues. Well, that may all be true. But if it's true that revolution is something that's not about thinking first and then acting, but just something that grows organically out of our daily lives, out of our inevitable resistance to a stupid world, then we must be able to find some of that as we look around. It must already be a presence in our lives. In many of cases, we our own the dichotomy that we actually exist in between work that we do to survive and get money and then all the other things we do to fully engage with our humanity, it's really right at that dichotomy where you find those moments of liberatory possibility, of self-emancipatory visioning in practical behaviors. So that's kind of where this book grew out of, is it an attempt to really kind of get inside of what's happening right now. You know, there's an old saw about the seed of the new growing in the shell of the old. And Nowtopia is what I want to refer to that as, is what we're trying to get to. So I'm going to read you a little bit of some of the work that I've written. I've already done a first draft of this book, and I'm hoping to radically rewrite it over the next few, about 6 weeks, and get it into print as fast as possible, because it's going to change the world. So I'm going to just read you a few bits of it, and then we'll carry on the conversation. And this is jumping right into it, sort of an excerpt. As capitalism continues its inexorable push to corral every square inch of the globe into the logic of money and markets, while simultaneously seeking to colonize the very essence of biological life and dominate our very thoughts, new practices are emerging that are redefining politics. Instead of traditional forms like unions or parties, people are coming together in practical projects. Rarely do these new configurations correspond to workplaces, occupations, or neighborhoods. Just as rarely do the individual participants necessarily conceive of their projects in specifically political terms. Nevertheless, as we shall see, there are common qualities to the activities that are early examples of this deep transformation. These efforts are still small in proportion to the entire population. In practical ways, without any politics or stated agenda, more and more people are freely engaging in activities that move toward self-emancipation. To be sure, few, if any, of the participants would characterize their own behavior this way. Class consciousness is not present, except insofar as many participants actively reject class as a way of understanding their own lives. In myriad behaviors, people are appropriating their time and their technological know-how from the market, and in small, invisible ways are making life better right now. And doing so, they are also setting the foundation, technically and socially, for a genuine movement of liberation from market life. These practical acts can best be understood in terms of class, and ultimately a classless society. The curious dialectic between consciousness and behavior plays out in emergent communities engaged in social reinvention. An equally dramatic dialectic of liberation and co-optation repeatedly traps these same efforts as they seek exodus from the limits of markets and money. The two crucial components of this exploration of self-emancipatory tendencies in this culture are time and the technosphere. People are engaged in activities that go on outside of their jobs in their so-called free time. These practices, often very time-consuming and strenuous, let's face it, people work really hard outside of their jobs, require sharing and mutual aid and constitute the beginnings of new kinds of communities. This represents a recomposition, to use some jargon, of the working class, even though most of the participants wouldn't embrace such a framework. Because these people are engaged in creative appropriation of the technosphere to purposes of their own design and choice, these activities embody the partial transcendence of the wage labor prison by workers who have better things to do than their jobs. I dub this crowd, hopefully, Nowtopians. They are tinkerers working in the waste streams and open spaces of late capitalism, conjuring new practices while redefining life's purpose. In the context of a globe-straddling voracious economy that systematically preys on human creativity, cooperation, and community, simple acts of mutual aid and local self-reliance are subversive. Joining together to meet basic needs produces new communities, new networks of human conviviality. The bonds thus created and the material experience of cooperation outside of economic regulation become a breeding ground for strategic and tactical thinking and practice that confronts the everyday objectification to which capitalism reduces us all. So part of the reason that this came to me also is that I was born in 57 and I kind of started to be really aware of the world in the beginning of 1970, late 60s, 70s. And, you know, that was the high point. If you look at the stats of, like, economic distribution, the highest real wages in the society in history was around 72, 73. The other memorable thing in 1973, which I lived through, maybe most people in this room didn't, was the first oil crisis, when the price of oil suddenly shot up from, I think it was 30-some cents a gallon to 70 cents a gallon. It seemed really shocking at the time. And that's the beginning of a counterattack by capital on the entrenched working class in this empire, in the center. And so you see this process. If you haven't read it, I recommend the book Midnight Notes, Midnight Oil by the collective Midnight Notes, for a nice overview of the changing function of the price of oil in controlling class politics or shaping class politics, both from the point of view of resistance around the world and the reproduction of domination as we live it. So you go through this period from the 70s onwards, and if you look back, there is a series of intact networks of human beings in working class communities, ethnic communities, neighborhoods, workplaces, that had had a long period of time up until then, from the end of World War II till the late 60s and early 70s, to essentially create networks of resistance, to create networks of rebellion that were quite successful. There was a huge social rebellion going on in the late 60s. And it took a lot of different forms, and we tend to denigrate it these days as, oh, those hippies, or, oh, the 60s, and they just forget about it. But actually, when you start to unpack it and look at the details of what was going on then, many of the things that were started during that time, many of the impulses for rebellion are very much in a state of sort of, you can follow the continuities to the present. And so what I'm arguing is that we live through a period, a cycle that you can see in various places throughout history. There's these cycles of capitalist development in which capital figures out how to accumulate, how to make profits, and how to, you know, keep the system of profit going well. And at a certain point, the people who are being exploited figure out how to resist that. And there creates a crisis in profitability, and then things fall apart. And at that point, there's either revolution, which has not happened successfully very often, or there's a series of restructurings and recapitulations of how capitalism is going to accumulate. They have to break those log jams, stop those impediments to accumulation. What are the two basic ways of doing it since World War II? Automate the work, move it somewhere else. And so since the late 60s and early 70s, since they're, you know, basically 72 onwards, you break down the international monetary system, and then you have this radical restructuring of the global economy, which we now refer to rather casually as globalization. So of course, globalization goes well back into the 19th century and even before then. But the version we're living in is the product of this specific restructuring that's taken place since the 70s. So if it's true that there's these cycles, then it must also be true that we might be reaching a point, maybe not today, maybe it's next week, maybe it's 2 years from now, I don't know exactly. But I feel like the things that I'm looking at, the kinds of activities that I'm interested in, are examples of what I'm calling working class recomposition. And it's not because I want everybody to go around waving a red flag saying, I'm a worker, I could care less. I actually find it interesting that a lot of what people are doing are actually escaping the limits of being simply a worker in this world. But there is this process of people coming back together in these new communities. We have to rebuild trust, we have to rebuild a way to know each other. And this has been something that I think a lot of people on the broadly defined left, which I'm sure all of you share my general antipathy for here, nevertheless have a difficult time recognizing the essential truth. You cannot talk about revolution, you cannot talk about overthrowing the world we're in, if you don't at least know your neighbors and know your friends and know who you can trust and have people that you can converse with and develop a vision with. And so I don't, you know, this is not like a prescription where, you know, you should all go out now and follow this plan, but the fact is that people are doing it. It's actually already underway. You can see it in all kinds of areas of our lives. So one of my favorite topics, I'm not going to go into reading you excerpts about the specifics that I'm talking about, but I'll just give you the list really fast. I have specific chapters on the outlaw bicycling subculture, on the free software movement, on community gardening, which is a really interesting and diverse phenomenon, on urban permaculture, and on the biofuels movement, and even, believe it or not, and I'm sure some of you will get your hackles up on this one, Burning Man. Because I think the Burning Man is actually a cultural space. Of course it costs a fortune to go. Of course it's totally hypocritical. Of course. That's a given. But why do people have such a passion to go there? Why do they get so involved with it when they get there? They're actually having a lived experience of getting outside of the market, getting completely outside of what we call the economy. Granted, it's based on this fraudulent foundation. That's a given. But nevertheless, it's a very interesting subjective experience to get up there. And if you've never been there, you have to try it to know. 5 minutes, okay, I'm going to really hurry up then. Anyway, so these various activities, I think, are places where people are coming back together in new kinds of communities. And really, these become the breeding grounds and the place of formation of a new vision of how different life could be, that it's going to take place, that it's going to be a life that doesn't succumb to the narrow logic of the economy where everything is subject to pecuniary evaluation, everything is for sale, all your time and life is bought and sold all day long. No, it's actually, we're really getting it, that people want to escape that truth, and there's a tremendous effort going on in a lot of these different arenas around, like, for instance, DIY bike shops. We have the Bike Kitchen here in San Francisco, and the Pedal Rev started that way, and the Bike Hut's still a little bit like that too, where people come together to actually work on bikes together. And people come across different ethnicities and classes to do that. And the other piece I want to just make a mention of here is this notion of the middle class. The middle class is a myth. There's really not any such thing as a middle class. What you have is well-paid workers who have been brainwashed for years into thinking that their real status is determined by what they can buy and what they can own rather than what they do. And so I'm really interested in helping shift the conversation back to a discussion of what do we do? Because everybody, no matter where you are in the hierarchy of wages and the hierarchy of social rights, and there is severe differentiation and severe inequality on all those issues. There's like a whole interlocking matrices of exploitation and inequality. We could argue about that forever. And as you may know, if you've been in this community for any length of time, we do. And I think that's worth paying attention to, why your condition is what it is. The specificity of your lived history is really important. Everybody should find out what that is. But as we go forward, we really need to start thinking more about what we have in common. And what we have in common is that we get up every day and we reproduce this stupid world. And we actually could be making something really different than this if we were in conversation with each other, if we were actually beginning to develop a shared vision. And my argument with this book, which I no longer have time to read you any more excerpts, and I know you're glad about, is to say that these things are actually happening, and that the book's purpose is to help promote those kinds of activities as breeding grounds, and to find the commonalities between those kinds of activities and even things way beyond what I've described, because I don't have the final word on anything, and I wouldn't ever want it. But I think it's very interesting to say that we are, you know, when you think about revolution, it tends to be this kind of bizarre separation. Oh, revolution, that's happening over here. We're over here in this world. There's no way to go from here to there. And what I want to say is no, actually, that we're all always doing it, and that there's actually chances to expand those activities once we start to identify their really core values. And the most important core value, in my not-so-humble opinion, is the anti-market quality, the willingness to get outside of the monetary cycle and do things because you're passionately engaged with them, they make you feel fully alive as a human being, and not only that, they make life better right now. Hopefully, they'll make life better in the long run, too. So I'll leave it there and throw it open to Q&A. I'm sure you all have many more things to say about it than I do, even. Rebuttals, denunciations, they're all welcome.
What is your education background?
College dropout. Question was, what's my educational background? Yeah, I farted around in college for a while. I really hated it. I thought it was a huge waste of time, and I had better things to do, so I left. Got involved in starting lots of crazy radical media projects over the years and continue to spend a ridiculous amount of my time doing things completely for free because I really do live what I just talked about. Like, I have luckily found enough money from the certain little limited activities that I do to survive so that I can spend a huge amount of my actual creative life doing things for free. And I don't think it's a model. Like, I don't think I could say, oh, you should live like I do. That's not my argument at all. But just to recognize the sort of compelling value of being able to dedicate yourself when you can to doing what matters and waking up in your life and in your everyday existence to make that a conscious choice. Why do this and not that? Why not do what needs to be done? Why do we, as a society, so undervalue important work and so drastically overvalue things that are not only a waste of time but are actually fucking things up really bad? Those people are raking it in. They get huge rewards. So I think as we sort of engage with these choices of how we want to reproduce the world, we get somewhere really fast. So that's part of my argument. Yeah. Can I cite some examples of dialectic in the world? Sorry? Well, absolutely. I think that, you know, most people are stuck doing a job they probably don't like very well or feel somewhat empty about at best. You know, like, oh, yeah, I'm going to go there. Well, every once in a while, like, for instance, I like to use the example of people working in medicine because a lot of us have developed a critique over the last 20 or 30 years of Western medicine and what's wrong with it. But then when your friend needs a heart transplant or brain surgery or cancer or whatever, you're really glad that you can take them to a hospital and get all this stuff. So there's no question that there's a kernel of something really useful and valuable there. And what's interesting is the people who do that work, the nurses, the doctors, all the people up and down, the janitors, et cetera, they're actually doing something useful part of the time they're there. But look at how much of the time they're spending in their jobs that are really stupid because they're basically catering to the needs of the insurance industry or the needs of these absurd wage differentials or whatever, that there's a whole structure that's imposed on useful work there that really gets in the way. So what to me is really interesting to take that as sort of a tiny example is the possibilities of a revolt of science and technical workers. Because in a way, a lot of us have developed a lot of skills, and a lot of the stuff that I'm talking about in this book is a practical DIY revolt against professionalism. And it's a very science and technology-based movements that are going on at the base of society. And a lot of anarchists are like, oh, I'm anti-technology. Well, that's absurd. You know, we live in a complex society. Unless you want to drop the H-bomb and get it over with and go back to, you know, tiny population living on hunting and gathering, let's get on to figuring out how to live on this complicated world, which means making good use of our skills. And it doesn't mean automatically adopting capitalist technologies or assuming that there's something inevitable or inherent about what we've gotten. But to throw it all out all at once and act like that's an intelligent politics to me is laughable. And it's exactly one of the major reasons why anarchism as an ism seems so unappealing to so many people, because the starting point is not to say you at your job subjectively have great power and you can change what you do and you can challenge the meaning of your work every day when you go back to work. That's the dialectic at the workplace that everybody could be engaged with. So thanks for that good question.
Thank you, Chris Carlson. Just FYI, Chris has a table with one of his many projects, Shaping San Francisco, in the main room.